talk to us about the evolution of consciousness and so on. So I know you're all very interested in the subject, and I'll get Hugh to give us his biography first, and you'll be able to tell how very learned he is. Thank you, Hugh.
I wasn't expecting that. Perhaps first I should say, if you didn't know, the lady who's just spoken to you is Joy Perkins, who has done massive job organising this evening. So really it's her, as well, of course, as our speaker, that we need to thank for tonight.
Thank you.
Well, I've been asked to say a little about Professor Conway Morris's career and achievement so far. Professor Simon Conway Morris is Professor of Evolutionary Paleobiology at the University of Cambridge, where he's been based in the Department of Earth Sciences for a number of years. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society and received the George Gaylord Simpson Prize from Yale University and the Lyell Medal of the Geological Society of London. In 1996, he presented the televised Royal Institution Christmas Lectures, which had the title The History in Our Bones, and has regularly contributed to TV and radio programs. In 2007, he gave the Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh under the title Darwin's Compass: How Evolution Discovers the Song of Creation. The author of many publications, his best known book is probably Life's Solutions: Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe. He is well known for speaking on the compatibility of scientific discoveries with the Christian faith, and so we are delighted that he can be here this evening. His title, as was being shown on the screen just recently, is The Evolution of Consciousness, A Window onto Invisible Worlds? Question mark. It's my pleasure to hand over to Simon.
Yeah, I've got. Oh God, hell, that was good, wasn't it? Yeah, hang on, go away. And if we can have the first slide up, if that's okay. I can improvise if there aren't any, by the way. So, yeah. So my thanks especially to Joy for inviting me down here, and for you for sacrificing your television viewing time and the like. But if you're like me and have absolutely no interest, who here couldn't give a toss about the World Cup? Well done, brilliant, excellent. Keep it up. Yeah. Who follows hurling them croquet? Well done. Yeah, that's us. I think Joy wants roughly 35, 40 minutes, so I may suddenly stop talking. That's roughly the time you're thinking of.
Sorry?
35, 40 minutes thereabouts. Spiel. Yeah. That's okay. Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here, and those of us like. Many of you, not all of you, remember this in 1976. It's the same sort of summer, be warned. So, as you can see, this slide must be people in America, where else? Somewhat disorientating in that way. And perhaps I'm bringing you here on false pretenses because I'm going to have a slightly circuitous route as to what we might think about consciousness. But if you have the next slide, please. And again, not to upset perhaps some of the evangelicals here, possibly. And I'm very happy to defend any of this in questions, but I will otherwise go quite quickly. Darwin got it right. Okay, we are a product of evolution. As Hugh mentioned, the history in our bones, you know, throughout our molecular structures, throughout our anatomical structures, we are patently part of a wider biosphere, which is the result of common descent, as Darwin outlined. And I could say much more about Darwin and he was the most remarkable genius. That's not the point to talk about today, other than I'm not here to dispute the realities of evolution or creationism or anything like that. So next slide, please. But is that the end of the story? Well, I suggest possibly not. There have always been lines of, actually a bit like Christianity, there have always been lines of heterodoxy, and a contemporary of Charles Darwin is this man here, Richard Owen. He was a very distinguished anatomist. He too subscribed to the reality of evolution, but he emphatically did not subscribe to Darwin's mechanism, principally revolved around natural selection. And again, it would take a long time to unpack where the differences lay, but in essence, I think what this chap was trying to do was actually to see if there's a deeper level of organization in evolution, which to some extent determined what the end products might be. And next slide, please. And amongst the other things for which he was very well known as a Victorian was that he was instrumental in the foundation of the Natural History Museum. And everybody here, I think, will be familiar with it. I spent a lot of time there when I was brought up in Wimbledon and Raynes Park. And of course, you'll see that it is no accident that this museum resembles a cathedral. It's a cathedral of science. It's Romanesque style, as you can see. Curiously enough, the people who opposed the foundation of this Natural History Museum was Charles Darwin, and the next slide, please. Oh, sorry, go on to the next slide, please. I'll come back to that in just... Oh, I'm completely out of sequence. Can we go back two slides? I'll have to tell you who I'm talking about. That's it. Stay there. Thank you. Sorry. It's Thomas Henry Huxley. And the reason for this was effectively political and the like, but Owen was a driving force for natural history, the museum, the Nathemus, as we used to call it. So the point about this, then, is that although there's a broad agreement about the reality of evolution, then there are different approaches to it. Now if I could have the next slide, I'm sorry to get these in the wrong order. Now, if I was to show the picture here in a biological conference, an evolutionary conference, it would not go down at all well. But in essence, what I'm going to try and persuade you over the next 20 minutes or so is that the arguments put forward by David Stove, an Australian philosopher, and he wrote quite a lot about Plato, he wrote quite a lot about Hume and the like, is what he referred to as Darwinian fairy tales. And again, don't misunderstand me. What he's arguing here is not that there's some sort of creationism, but the realities of evolution he's completely happy about, that we are descendants of apes and all the rest of it. But, he continued, if you're trying to persuade me that what makes us human can be extrapolated from the animals in terms of things like altruism and the like, or even rather paradoxically, our love of pets and so forth, then you've got to be joking. And the reason why I like to draw attention to Stove's work is, first of all, I don't think it's that well known in this country, but more importantly, he was an atheist. He had no truck with the, you know, any sort of religions and so forth. He wasn't trying to introduce a religious agenda here at all. But he was insistent as a philosopher that trying to find the, if you like, mental continuity was something which was deeply, deeply problematic. Can I have the next slide, please? And I've touched on this. Hugh very kindly mentioned one book, Life Solution. I named that because I wanted to get the book on the self-help shelves. And this is a more recent one, which is almost unobtainable in this country, I'm pleased to say. And if you say it quickly enough, it sounds like the ruins of evolution. But yeah, the next slide, please. Oh, here's Huxley. Sorry, I put him in the wrong order. I do apologise. So there he is, enthroned in a natural history museum. And Huxley is, if you like, the sort of predecessor of many other insistent and vociferous secular agents, most famously Richard Dawkins, of course, who, if expressed in no uncertain terms, as Darwin himself intuited, that in effect, if we are just one tiny twig on the history of life, so here we've got what evolutionary biologists call a tree of life. It's not a complete one. And if you get out your opera glasses, you can see there's a little red box over on the right-hand side, which outlines animals. That's you and me, but not only humans, but everything else. And the point about this is that from this perspective, one could say, well, really, is it not true that as one tiny twig on this huge arborescence, this tree of life, we are utterly insignificant? One, of course, would immediately point out there's only one species on the planet that actually understands this. We can come back to that in a moment. But this thing, and the next slide, please, is something which you could refer to as an analogy to so-called Copernican mediocrity. Copernicus, as I'm sure you know, was one of the earlier astronomers, and he identified effectively it's more complicated now, but he identified a so-called heliocentric system, whereby, and again, this is a parody of what actually is the case, that we are not in any imaginable way the centre of the universe or anything else like that. Actually, the medievals understood this in a much more subtle way, but that's yet another story. But you can argue that there's an analogy to this in terms of a Darwinian mediocrity. After all, if we're just one tiny species in this enormous biosphere, how possibly can we be of any significance? The next slide, please. And underpinning this has been a widespread, not assumption, but really a sort of ground truth in evolution, that things are very largely a matter of chance, you know, that history could go in that direction or this direction. So you throw the die as many times as you like, and sometimes you end up with a dinosaur, sometimes you end up with a porpoise, and so on and so forth. And then next slide, please. And amongst the most I'm trying to think of the right word, sort of, but the one amongst the most clear exponents of this point of view, although it is, I think, a view held by nearly all evolutionary biologists, was Stephen Jay Gould, a very distinguished American paleobiologist in Harvard. And he wrote a book about work which I did with others on a very famous fossil locality. And I say very famous, that means that three people in the room have heard about it. This is the Burgess Shale. And the point about, if I can have the next slide, please, the point about Gould's work and his analysis, which drew in part on some of not so much my ideas, but things I had said, was that, as he famously said, if we were to rerun the tape of life, if we were to go back to the time of the Cambrian explosion, when this amazing Burgess Shale was deposited, with all these fantastically well-preserved animals, and therefore if we allowed a history to rerun, again, I don't have a pointer, I'm afraid, but you can perhaps just see on the far left-hand side somebody in his underwear, that's not me, but a human, and so forth. What is the likelihood of all the twists and turns of history ending up with anything like a human? Again, it's underlying this Darwinian mediocrity. Yes, there will be a biosphere, yes, it will have various occupants, but from this perspective, humans are completely accidental. They're just another species. Next slide, please. Thank you. And this view that there could be counterfactuals is one which also interests historians very much. And not being so far from Kenley, of course, is actually quite relevant. But there are a whole set of books which explore how history might have gone in slightly different directions. And I hope many of you have seen the film Darkest Hour. It was cracking good. There we go. That's where my sympathies lie. But one could imagine that if Halifax had become premier, then I'm going to be very slightly careful when I say about Brexit now. Very, very slight, very slightly careful. I think in that situation, or if Chamberlain hadn't had the cancers and so forth, then we could have capitulated. Thank God we had Churchill, in my view. But even so, it seemed to be a narrow-run thing at the time. Now, next slide, please. And in this particular set of essays, one which has always fascinated me, is one by a historian in Yale. And I don't have to explain, I think, to almost anybody here what this scene is, because this is Pontius Pilate. But it's a counterfactual history. And he's got all this screaming mob down there, and he's looking from the pavement and so forth, saying, oh, God, I can't stand these people. God, they're so boring. So he turns to the prisoner Jesus and says, you're free. And then very, very quietly, in the very, very best of luck, history would have been unimaginably different. Or would it? Because if you have a chance to read this essay, actually it's very, very ingenious. It's very clever. It's got a wonderful twist at the end. But from the views of counterfactuals, as one might see in human history, correspondingly in biological history, the received wisdom is that it could have gone that way, it could have gone that way. I mean, in the case of Pilate, frankly, the little we know about him, the chances of Jesus being released were zilch. But you never know. He was, you know, he's an extremely bloody-minded individual, that's clear enough. So let that be. Next slide, please. Oh, there we go. And that's the one there with the thing for the self-help shelves and so forth. Right. So the argument which I've become interested in is not so much the fact that something like a human is an inevitability, and this I base in part on an area of evolutionary biology known as convergence, and I won't say much about that, but the fact is that there seem to be a rather limited number of solutions, if you like, and I won't be talking again, unfortunately, about that, although it might have a theological dimension, but it is that paradoxically, I think we're completely alone, which is absolute nonsense, so there we are, you've heard it from me. But there are a number of other aspects about this which have, if you like, been germinating in the years since this book was published. Next slide, please. And it is as advertised. At last he's going to tell us what he's going to tell us, isn't he? At last 15 minutes of waffle. Who brought him here? is this question of consciousness. And some perspectives, it's simple. You know, brain makes mind. From other perspectives of most philosophers these days, it remains profoundly mysterious. And I'm in the latter camp, not because I think it's profoundly mysterious in being a sense of never being able to be understood, but I think our present approaches, at least the scientific ones, are unlikely to be successful, or at least they're going to be incomplete. And next slide, please. As many of you all know, to the first approximation, most approaches to explaining consciousness are, and again, I'm being very crude here, and people, the scientists here will be wincing already, but it's reductionist and it's mechanistic. It's a thing that is a machine That's all there is to it. And the next slide, please. And amongst the exponents of that, perhaps one of the best known is Daniel Dennett in Tufts University in Boston. And this, by and large, is the area of received wisdom. And that's fine and large. And the next slide, please. And what I'm going to do very quickly now, and it's going to be, well, literally a dog's breakfast, as you'll see in a moment, is actually try and reopen David Stove's observation with regard to Darwinian fairy tales as to what are the continuities, from a Darwinian perspective, they're obvious, versus what appear to be the discontinuities between animal cognition and our cognition. Because clearly we have the common root, and yet there are a whole set of differences. And the more I've been thinking about this, the more struck I am about the uniqueness of humans. What is it about us which provides such advantages, yet apparently, other animals just don't get it? So that's the argument for continuity. Next slide, please. There are lots and lots of problems here. I mean, the first, of course, is that we are deeply anthropomorphic, and we're also anthropocentric. And any of you, I'm not going to ask who has a cat here. I'm not interested. No, sorry. But dog owners in particular know, as one woman said, writing about her dog, you know, I speak to my dog as if it's got a degree from Harvard, you know, the dog's got no idea what it's talking about at all. But it is this, again, the animals have emotions. I'm sure they're conscious in a sense. I'm not disputing that for a moment. But nevertheless, we export what we regard as our feelings into the animal mind. And this can sometimes be deeply misleading. The next slide, please. And there are many such examples of this, which again and again appear to show at first sight a very convincing cognitive capacity amongst animals, which on further investigation turn out to be nothing of the sort. And this is really just a sort of list of things, and it's not in any particular order. One thing that we have a dog, heaven help us, but I've got to rush back and look after it when I get married. If, of course, your southern railways allows me to get there, that's another story. Dogs know the names of toys, okay? And you can train dogs. There's a couple of famous ones. Bailey and Chaser are the heroes in this area. And they know the names of hundreds of toys. And at first sight, it looks as if they actually know what that name is. But you can, and again, I can unpack this if you want to. There are a further set of experiments you can do which make it abundantly clear that although Bailey knows that this toy is Muffin and this toy is Rhino and so forth, it hasn't got the foggiest idea of a name. It doesn't actually understand that there's an association of meaning to this thing at all, even though it, at first sight, it's a very impressive performance indeed. And dogs, of course, are perhaps a worst example because they're semi-symbiotic with us in any case, and they've spent 30,000 years getting two meals a day, so they can't really complain. You know, it's another, next slide, please. There are other such examples because from the point of view of evolutionary convergence, I think that if you can find groups of animals which are, for example, not mammals, such as birds, which are also cognitively extremely competent, then that in a sense gives you some confidence that one's dealing with the same property. And the New Caledonian crows, you'll be familiar with jackdaws around here and that sort of thing, I'm sure. But the crows generally, the corvids, are famously intelligent. That's not in dispute. The New Caledonian crows are particularly interesting because they are toolmakers in the wild. And this particular case, rather famous one, this is Betty. She was living in Oxford. She died some years ago, state funeral in St. Giles, very impressive, you know, outside Balliol, beautiful sight. Was actually that she was given a straight piece of wire, and there was a bucket there, recessed in the tube, with food in it. And you can see her hopping around in the video, and she can't get the bucket out. And then suddenly she hops down, pushes the wire against the side of the tray to make a hook, lowers the hook into the recess, and as you can see, here is successfully lifting the bucket out. And at first sight, this is fantastically spectacular, and there's applause all round, very, very good. But it turns out on closer examination that in point of fact, this sort of behavior is innate. It's part of what they do in the wild. They're hook makers any case. It's cognitively impressive, I don't dispute that, but it isn't quite the same cause and effect, which we take for granted. And this is even more strikingly shown, I think in the next slide, please, where there are related experiments which revolve around the famous fable from Aesop, of dropping the stones, Archimedes style, to raise the level of the water, or in my case, wine, but that's another story, so that one can get a drink. And on the right-hand panel, we see the modern-day analogue, whereby the birds are dropping things into the cylinder of water so that eventually the food, the treat, the reward comes up at the top. And here too, at first sight, it seems to be, yes, they're putting one and one together. But you can do more complicated experiments by, for example, introducing a U-tube, which has got a hidden recess, or you can have three tubes. And it becomes pretty clear that these animals will learn very quickly, that's not in dispute, but they don't actually join the dots. They are not capable, it seems, of understanding what we take for granted in terms of cause and effect. And I think, not to give the game away immediately, but what we are finding ourselves in is a completely different sort of world. It is a world full of meaning, and of course, received wisdom out there is that this meaning is more or less human invented and is merely sort of to keep us comfortable and so forth, but a philosophical view would take a rather more robust sense that these things are underpinned in the way which Plato in particular articulated. So next slide, please. So, you know, one has this sort of thing about us versus other animals, and the snapshot halfway through the talk is the caption which goes with this is what other species would think this is a sensible thing to do. And I just encourage you, for want of a better word, the train I came down this afternoon was absolutely grim. You know, everyone packed together like that. And, well, people were very patient. When Hugh kindly picked him up, I said, when are they going to have a revolution? He wasn't so sure. I think it's quite soon, actually. But our capacity in things like cooperation and so forth really have no counterpart amongst the animals. So next slide, please. And again, to continue this sort of list, as already pointed out with the New Caledonian crow, many animals are tool makers. Chimpanzees are particularly famous for their termite dipping and their ant dipping and so forth. But in effect, what they never do is use one tool to make another tool. And thereby, they are denied what we would call a cumulative technology, whereby you build one structure on another. And I just use as an example one which may be familiar to some of you, the so-called Antikythera mechanism, which was recovered from a wreck in the 19th century, and on a further analysis, made of brass, probably built around about 100 AD, probably in Alexandria, is the most astonishing piece of technology. And the gearing system in this is effectively to provide an astronomical calculator, which of course is built not on the Copernican system, but on the earlier Ptolemaic system, whereby the sun went round the earth rather than vice versa, and so on and so forth. So although the tool making of animals at first sight seems to be the first step to what we did, and in one sense that must be true, in point of fact, probably at least 3 or 4 million years ago, the tools we start to make in Africa are somehow different. They've actually got, if you like, a cognitive imprint in them. The person understands in a sense that this tool, and this is something that's very peculiar, which we take for granted, which animals probably do not have, is that our tools are a cognitive extension of ourselves. And this is something which is as true of a Acheulean hand axe as it is of a cell phone. So next slide. And this is, and again, to sort of repeat myself, I'm afraid, with regards to why I think we're so unlike other animals, even though we have a commonality of descent, is that we think out of the box. We can think about analogies. We can see, for instance, one has reason to believe that a chimpanzee, given a banana or an apple, is very happy to have those, might prefer one, that's perfectly reasonable, but it has no concept of fruit. It would have no concept of a pippin or a plantain or any sort of variety of the fruit. It is just an apple. Whereas we, of course, erect this whole series of categories which allow us to effectively either find, invent, or invade completely new worlds, including this one here. Next slide, please. And again, one steps back and says, well, hang on a moment, you know, animals are certainly aware of each other. Whether they can read each other's minds is still controversial. And a famous example, which appears again to belie my tenor so far, are such examples as cooperative hunting by chimpanzees, where they will seize on a luckless, a colobus monkey and tear it apart. It's not very pretty, I have to say. Only the males do the hunting, and so forth. There can be up to 30 of them going together. At first sight, it looks very much similar to the way humans hunt. But again, on closer examination, it turns out that actually there is no plan, there is no strategy there. They're working as a pack of individuals. There is no, if you like, group mind there, which is something, again, humans possess. In the next slide, please. Another thing which is actually rather odd, and again, we almost take for granted, is that humans have two propensities which are not unknown amongst animals, but very rare indeed, and those are mimicry. That's why we find comics so amusing, in part, but also coordination of movement. A rather sinister example there from good old Europe, or a rather more benign example, can't stand ballet myself, but I thought I'd better put it up. And the point about this is that our capacity, like river dancing and so forth, is if you could just step back a few yards, it's astonishing. It's so peculiar. You know, if you can actually think of yourself out of the box, it's absolutely bizarre. And yes, there aren't dancing bears, but they're not dancing. Next slide, please. Music, first sight, seems to be that there are close parallels between bird song, the songs of the humpback whales and things like that. And some years ago, I was promoting reasonably vigorously the idea that not only were they convergent, but in fact, again, they were, if you like, the nascent underpinnings of human music. But I'm beginning to wonder whether that's, in a sense, really correct, because human music, again, is actually different. Yes, it has notes and so forth. Yes, birds have melodies and harmonies and inventions and the like. But human music is very peculiar because it's full of meaning, but it's completely meaningless. And it has levels of interpretation which find a close analogy to language and to mathematics, which you never see in animal song. Next slide, please. And this, when I speak about language again, is something where the orthodox Darwinian explanations, and don't misunderstand me, I'm not trying to knock the animal behaviour area at all. I mean, their patience training these animals to do these things is beyond praise. But the general notion has been, of course, that here I am articulating, I have a language and so forth. And the roots of this should go deep into evolutionary history. And the star turn in this area are the so-called vervet monkeys in Africa, and they have three distinct calls. Again, those of you who know this area will know I'm simplifying somewhat. One for a leopard, one for a snake, and one for an eagle. And as you can see in the top panel there, in this particular case, the call for the eagle didn't quite work out, did it? But there we are. And this has been regarded, again, as proto-words. These are the beginnings of our language. But once again, further investigation suggests it's nothing of the sort. No animal has language. Now, next slide, please. The reason is, from my perspective, extremely puzzling. Why is it that language is so rich and so various? What is it about our ability to construct not only semantics, but also the syntax, which allows us to have effectively an almost infinitely deep series of meanings, whereas animal vocalizations are more or less flat, more or less? And I think that all of these observations, be it with tool making, or whether it be cooperation, or music, or language, in a certain way are all part of exactly the same story. They're all interconnected one to the other, because all of them, in one way or another, are resonating with a sort of universe where meaning is genuine, where we actually understand things, not simply because they are understandable, but because we are meant to be able to understand them. And you can see straight away that there is at least a religious thread you could draw through that if you so wish. You don't have to, there's no need to, but there's a degree of consistency, possibly so. And the point about language is that its origins are still open to debate. There are lots of ideas, of course, but the general idea that animal vocalization tells us much about the origin of language looks on pretty thin ground now. I'm enormously influenced by this chap up here. Some of you may recognize him. This is I've just reading a book at the moment about this, a draft book, The Last Inkling. This is Owen Barfield. He was a great chum of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and Charles Williams, of whom I'm fans of all of them. And again, I don't have time to unpack that, but and his writing is pretty dense, but he had some very interesting ideas about the origins of language, which in a nutshell were to argue that it is when we become, as he put it himself, mythopoeic, when we find ourselves actually in new worlds which are inaccessible to other groups, and language is part of this exploration. And he has some, he's got a whole series of other ideas. I think his time will come back. He's a very underestimated figure. So next slide, please. And as I mentioned, he was very, very influential on J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm a great fan of Tolkien, as some of you are, some of you aren't, I suppose, and especially The Lord of the Rings and so forth. And there's something about that trilogy in particular, which is more than fantasy and so forth. That ability to sub-create, as Tolkien himself put, is something which actually is touching a very, very deep nerve, at least in myself, and I think with a number of other people. This is something which is not just storytelling. Now, next slide, please. And the reason why language, as I've already hinted, is so remarkable is because it has this power of almost indefinite recursion. So that if you know where to put the commas, this sentence immediately makes sense. But said, if you say it off very quickly like that, the clergy know that I know, etc., etc., then you know one can actually take layer upon layer upon layer of meaning. And this, I think, again, is part and parcel of this reflection of our humanness. And the next slide, please. So in totality, what this suggests is, using this painting from a German romantic painter, Caspar David Friedrich, that when we talk in these sort of archetypal terms of voyages and things like that, and when we have artists who can capture with such, in my perspective at least, such brilliance there, you know, this, as you can see, is just a thin smear of pigments on a piece of paper, for goodness sake. You know, pull yourself together, Richard, pull yourself together. But in point of fact, I think, again, this is actually arguing that we are looking into deeper worlds. Next slide, please. And we can continue this argument. I see time is moving on, so I'll conclude quite quickly and we can unpack things if you so wish. Is that, as with music, as with language, I think the same thing holds for mathematics. And I'm not a mathematician at all. I'm hopeless, I can hardly add. But the fact of the matter is that with regards to the ability to even engage in simple multiplication or addition, this is something no animal is capable of at all. And you might argue, in fairness, well, for goodness sake, they don't need to, and that may be fair enough. You talk to at least some of the mathematicians, not all of them, but a number of them will say that they don't invent what they work on, they discover it. And the question is, again, at first sight, animals have something which is, the next slide please, is comparable. Now, that's a very Cambridge picture for you, isn't it? Two glasses, exactly. Well, not quite enough bottles, but never mind. We'll manage, as we say. Animals have this capacity for what's known as numerosity. And by numerosity, what I mean is that they are able to engage in of approximations. And this is rather important if you are a social species, because you want to be able to distinguish, say, between whether there are 12 gazelles and 15 gazelles versus 3 gazelles and 40 gazelles. And so it turns out, if we look, take the next slide, that this ability to engage in numerical magnitude and numerical distance under the general rubric of numerosity is something which is possessed by very many animals, especially those which are social, such as these fish here. And this capacity, which you can measure in various ways, in point of fact, is of equal power and equal status to your typical undergraduate. So if you ask an undergraduate to engage in exercise in numerosity, he will come out just as well as your average animal. So this is obviously a very deep-seated capacity. And the argument has been that this capacity, so-called numerosity, this ability to judge relative numbers in terms of either distance or magnitude, are ones which underpin mathematics. And if we took it to the next slide. And in point of fact, this is very unlikely to be the case, because it turns out that the capacity for numerosity is sensory. And by that, what I mean is that if you think of two weights, like a stone here and a feather there, and you ask yourself, how much do I have to add or take away to either the feather or the stone to perceive a difference? It turns out, in fact, the distribution, on the next slide, please, follows a rather well-known logarithmic description, which is often referred to as Weber-Fechner's law. And all this tells you, so we can go back one slide, please, is that if you take a tiny bit away from the feather or add a tiny bit, it can be any weight you like, it doesn't have to be another piece of feather, you will perceive that difference more readily than you would, for instance, a stone which is much heavier, where you'd have to add much more or take away much more for you to perceive the difference. And that, and I'm going to have a short tirade here before I get my taxi back to the station, just in case I upset you, is incidentally the reason why there are weights and measures which are designed for humans, the pound and the ounce, distances, the yard, the foot and the mile, because you need 28 little grams to make an ounce. We're useless. This was invented by people who believed in pure rationality, which is very dangerous. It may be more perfect, but it's not actually designed for us. You walk a kilometre, it's not very far. Walk a mile, that's the first time the human frame begins to register. Similarly, a pound is a reasonable weight, a kilogram is a heavy weight. And this is because we have a gravity and all the rest of it. Enough of that. So, the next slide, please, is that the point about this Weber-Fechner law is that it applies to weights, but it also applies to numerosity. In other words, numerosity is a sensory process, whereas mathematics is an abstract process. And obviously we might need a pencil and paper to write things down, but I think again that that's indicative of the gulf there is between what appears to be a continuity between what many animals possess versus what we possess. And in that sense, it's very, very similar to language. And I think, next slide. Yeah, so I'll finish at this point here, perhaps provoke a few questions, because I can't take things in full circle. It's work in progress, and this is by no means an original idea. But there is a sense, and it's been articulated for more than 100 years, as I learned quite recently, that of course we need a brain to do our thinking. I'm not disputing that. Of course we need a mass of neurons here and all the rest of it. But one could look at our brains as being analogous to a filter. In other words, and this of course goes back to a philosophical tradition, that mind is there the whole time, and Barfield was very strong on this as well, that consciousness of a sort predates everything, and that we access this. And of course that in part explains why we have, as Paul famously said, through a glass darkly, that our understanding is limited. But also, I think it's encouraging because one of the curious things about being human is that, you know, things which are regarded as almost unteachable. When general relativity was first being explained to the most advanced scientists in the 1920s, it was regarded as one of the great Himalayas, the great Everest of understanding. It's taught in sixth form now, even below. And the reason is that I think, in a way, there is this cumulative addition of knowledge where things which appear to be very, very difficult at one stage actually become easier. So looking at ourselves as being embedded in a world of mental realities which predate ourselves is not specifically a Christian message. It could be, if you so wish. I don't have any quarrel with that. I wouldn't want to have a quarrel with that. But it does suggest that worlds visible and invisible, as we say, is actually something which is absolutely true. It's not simply an invention of ourselves. So I've gone on for, I think, 3 minutes too long, but I'll stop there. And Joy suggested if there were any questions, we might handle those. And then perhaps you can get back to your television sets. But no. Yeah, so thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Good. Just get some water. Thank you. You think this is water, don't you? The speaker requested Tanqueray, and he has it. Thank you. Does anybody else want a drink? A few questions, I think.
Well, thank you for a most interesting presentation, which I'm still circulating in my mind at the moment. You draw fundamental distinctions between the animal kingdom and ourselves. Is part of the difference accountable by brain size of the brain, or is part of it accountable in terms of fundamental brain process and independent of brain size and say brain capacity? Mm.
Well, in a sense, probably both, said he helpfully. It's difficult. You probably need a fairly big brain to do your thinking. But there's not a simple connection. That's evident, in, apart from anything else, from two lines of evidence. First of all, cranial capacity amongst living... Well, first of all, cranial capacity in modern humans has actually decreased a bit in the last 100,000 years. And there are actually perfectly good reasons for that. It hasn't made us any more stupid, I don't think. And also, there are genetic differences between ourselves and chimpanzees in terms of nervous things. There's also questions about neuronal density, which is why elephants aren't as intelligent as they should be. They've got a much lower, et cetera. So yes, all of those are factors to be considered. But the problem is that there are rare cases, but there are people, and they often go for a routine examination. They have an MRI scan or something, and the doctor says, "Where's your brain?" There are particular cases of people who have almost no brain to speak of, a veneer of tissue, and yet they are capable of fully, not all of them, some are severely disabled, but there are a number of cases of people who have huge holes in their brain, this is from birth, and yet it has, some of them are gifted mathematicians and so forth. So that clearly is part of the argument, but in the end, you've got to stand back and say, well, as with numerosity, there are neurons, at least in the macaque monkey, which recognize, so to speak, one and two. But I don't think a neuron recognizes anything. And that, I think, is a fundamental problem with anything with regard to our neural architecture versus our understanding. Yeah.
Am I right in understanding that where you're heading is that there is, the whole point is that there is meaning in the universe that we are supposed to discover?
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. It's not a fake. If I've been talking about extraterrestrials, which I'm quite interested in as well because there aren't any, but I mean, one of the explanations, I don't think it's correct, but it's actually worth taking seriously, is we live in a virtual universe. Oh dear, I know. There are ways you can test it, and it's actually provoked quite a lot of discussion. So that's a slightly different approach. But yes, your question is replied with an affirmative. Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's not a fake.
Given your thesis about the discontinuity between animal consciousness and human consciousness, what do you think happened when humans first emerged? This is the kind of $64,000 question, in the sense that I've had a lot
sure.
of leading up to.
Sure. No, I knew I'd be pinned down on this one. Your name, has somebody got this chap's address? No, thank you. It's opaque, to put it mildly. There is an archaeological record, of course. There are side issues such as the Neanderthals and a leading man and so forth. But I think the way to approach it, two things. It's pretty clear, as I hinted, that when we go to the earliest known stone tools, there's a sort of pre-older one culture, but according to most people, not everybody, they are not the same as the sorts of blocks of cobble which a chimpanzee uses to crack open a nut. There's a cognitive understanding about what, if you like, is in the way that a sculptor understands what is hidden in the stone. It appears. And I think the approach is rather than say, you know, there is a sudden time when everybody says, goodness gracious me, you know, I'm conscious, I can do this, that, and the other. It is that, in a sense, going back to the question just raised, that if one's got an invisible world which you're beginning to explore, then once you put your first toe in the metaphysical ocean, so to speak, then you're being invited continuously to, first of all, paddle, and ultimately swim. So, you know, and what I don't understand at all is we've got it, and given the supposed advantages, why doesn't any other animal ever get to do it? I mean, with birds in particular, you would think that if you've got complex vocalization, you've got a neural structure which is closely analogous to what we use in language, the young birds babble in the way that our children do before they crystallize their song, you would seem they're right on the threshold of language, but no. I find it, you know,
And I don't want to make it sort of, you know, goodness gracious me, we are special. First of all, we can do what we like to animals. That is not my argument, emphatically. In fact, I think it actually makes us more responsible for them, and there is possibly a biblical argument there, perhaps, discussed. And correspondingly, you know, that our position is one which is a gift rather than, you know, us strutting around over, you know, we're in charge of everything. Yeah, so, you know, there's an element of humility in this with Luck, yeah.
Chimpanzees again. In the 1970s, and I've lost contact with the research since then, there was some successful attempts to teach chimpanzee British Sign Language. Mm-hmm. And not only could they learn vocabulary, but they could generate conversation sentences which were yep. unique. They hadn't heard them before. How would you explain that?
That's true. I mean, this is Kanzi and his friends, or her friends. The thing that I don't have any, you know, dispute with that thing. One's got to remember, and I'm not trying to sort of say, well, my argument is in ruins. It is, first of all, of course, that this takes years and years and years of training, continuous. And that's a thing which I could have remarked on as well. But by and large, the amount of time you need to even teach animals to do simple things, so they don't have language, is staggering. An example I like to use in particular is this business of what's called entrainment, whereby I can't dance to save my life, much to my wife's disgust, but, you know, almost every, and I see that mass of instruments over there, and I imagine on Sunday morning you're all going like this, yes, I suppose, and clapping, good for you, very nice. That sort of entrainment is very seldom seen in animals, and a particular experiment was to see whether rhesus monkeys could anticipate a metronome change. And they spent a solid year, trying to train these rhesus monkeys to get it, and they didn't. And that, first of all, tells me much, much more about humans than it does about a rhesus monkey. Yeah. And I think with regard to these particular things, yes, indeed, if you've got, especially, so to speak, a homeschooled chimpanzee, if you've got animals in captivity, they're observant, they can be taught, whether they actually understand what this means in any useful sense. And typically speaking, there's analogous examples with cardinality and numbers and so forth. They might be able to, in the end, sort of rearrange the bricks and say, well, you know, you say banana, green, something or other, and they rearrange them, they've got a new meaning about it. But that, too, is a complete glass ceiling. And in the wild, so far as we know, and that is a dangerous area because, of course, you know, they spend most of the time out of sight. That thing has never arrived at. So I'm not saying, you know, in a sense, it's hinting back to the answer there. I mean, the capacity is there in principle, but it takes them, you know, it's mind-bogglingly difficult to get them over that hurdle. So these things do happen, yes, of course, but deeply enculturated animals who are intelligent will do things which look quasi-human. Yeah, sure.
Towards the end of the lecture, you said that perhaps mind could predate matter, in a sense. And I was wondering how the two would interact if the brain is a filter for the mind. How could they interact, seeing as the mind is utterly distinct to the brain?
I'm not trying to dismiss your question. I'm not a philosopher. He's not anything at all. Who brought him here? God's name. It's any attempt at the moment to try is a variant on a dualistic question with Descartes and company sort of identified. How do we manage to make sense of this? And of course, my materialist friends would say, well, this is all nonsense, you know, that it's all in the brain and so forth. And as I've tried to persuade you, they're on perhaps more fertile ways of getting it. It's opaque to me, because it's opaque not least because, yes, we've got very complicated circuits in our brains and all the rest of it, but that in itself doesn't seem to explain what the consciousness is. And consciousness, I think, is, as I say to young people, if you want to have an unsuccessful career, scientific career, study consciousness. Total graveyard. You know, I think the approaches of Barfield in particular are deeply neglected. And one of the things he points out, and it's something I've been slow to appreciate because he's not an easy read, and I should pay more attention, is that he argues that human consciousness itself has changed. And it actually goes back to similar arguments around a thing called the bicameral mind and so forth. That in a genuine sense, a Neolithic farmer or a Bronze Age warrior or possibly even a medieval peasant actually understood the world in a genuinely different way. And it's almost impossible for us to put ourselves back in that position. And that is reflected in Barfield's view in the way that language has evolved. He regards the language as almost being a fossil record of cognition. And that, to my way of thinking, is actually rather heartening, because it suggests that we can lose things in the process, but we can also gain things. But it, again, it's a sense there that, you know, we are impinging on a universal mind, and how we see it depends very much on our cultural background. And I'm not using this as a sort of relativistic, you know, an argument on race relations or anything like that. So that's not the point, but that might have validity. I don't have any view on it at all, but it's not that level of argument. It goes at a much, much deeper level, because this is talking about all humans. Yeah, so it's an inadequate answer, I'm afraid.
Thank you very much,
my
Dr. Conroy Morris. We really have to stop it there because there's a train to catch as well.
Well, I've got in my in my kitchen there's a spaniel, and he's looking at his watch and saying, well, "Where is it?" No, don't worry, no, it's okay. But also, as I say, when I got off the southern train this evening, it was in like sardines like this, and I'm right at the back on the far end of the door. Nobody's moving. I said, doesn't anybody like Pearly? And all sort of stuff. And then I fortunately managed to break the ice by saying, I'm terribly sorry, that's my lifeboat over there, and then they understood where I was coming from. So, yeah. But thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Just want to give you a token of appreciation. Oh,
thank you very much.
I hope you'll be able to carry that on the train.
I will open it on the train.
Thank you. And we'll have a closing prayer. Bishop David Atkinson will do that.
I'm a member of a group called the Society of Ordained Scientists. About 100 of us research degrees in science who are ministers in the church. And the society has its own prayer, which I'm going to read as our closing prayer in just a moment. Before that, I invite you just to keep a brief moment of quiet to turn something that we've heard this evening into a thanksgiving or a prayer, if you would like to do that. And then I shall read this prayer. Almighty God, creator and redeemer of all that is, source and foundation of time and space, matter and energy, life and consciousness, grant to all who study the mysteries of your creation grace to be true witnesses to your glory and faithful stewards of your gifts, through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Thank you. Just one more thing to tell you about our next meeting. The talk is very, very different, and it is, Can We Believe in Genesis Today? It's by Dr. Ernest Lucas, and the talk will be on the 18th of September. So I hope you can all come, and we'll again enjoy something very useful to all of us in our spiritual life. Thank you very much. Thanks.